virus the Americans were always making movies and writing books about. The infidels never did anything other than confirm it was contained on a continent they largely ignored. All they really cared about was that African diseases stayed in Africa. What made this outbreak different was that it had made it to the homeland and had gone airborne, or so they would believe. They would connect the dots from Cabinda in northern Angola to the 4 de Fevereiro International Airport in the capital to a flight landing in the United States. Ali needed at least 2 of the 4 target cities to be hit with the same infection. The virus would be traced to Angola, a country with a history of infectious tropical diseases. The most sophisticated intelligence agencies in the world would never trace it back to Iran. Of course, never was a word that made Ali cringe. Every plan needed a contingency. If the U.S. intelligence community did discern that the virus was not a naturally occurring disease, it would be traced back to homegrown terrorists inspired by what the talking heads like to call an ideology of hate. That Sebastian Phillips had grown up in the United States and worked in a university bio lab would only fuel the conspiracies. With COVID-19 having dominated the news cycle for so long, most of the country had at least heard the very real possibility that the coronavirus had first originated in a Chinese biocontainment facility in Wuhan. Either way, regardless of whether the United States traced the virus to Angola or if they discovered it was released into the environment by a terrorist organization made up of U.S. citizens, the result of an airborne pathogen with the infection and death rates of Marburg was the same. The only choice was for the United States government to release the antibodies that would destroy it. In this case, those antibodies were on standby in Hurlburt Field, Florida. MC-130s armed with the largest non-nuclear payloads ever developed. To save the country from an invisible virus, the United States would have no choice but to attack itself and incinerate the disease threatening to destroy the entire nation. As with a host whose immune system attacks an invading cancer, oftentimes that host did not survive. The United States was already on edge from COVID-19 and had almost destroyed their economy for a virus that was actually doing them a favor, killing off the weak. Pulling to the curb 3 blocks from his meeting location, Ali put the car in park and looked at 2 small children playing in the front yard of a house across the street. The home was neglected and the yard full of weeds, but the smiles on the children's faces were no different than the smiles of children the world over. An older boy looked on, possibly their brother, tasked with keeping an eye on them in this neighborhood just outside Chicago. He was about the same age Ali had been when he'd found his brother swinging from the noose, eyes bulging, tongue protruding from the left side of his mouth, a casualty of war. The wailing of his mother. Ali had been told that the asset in Chicago had been unreliable in his communications. The imam had expressed concerns. There were indications that the asset had been corrupted by Western values. There were no signs that he had been contacted by American law enforcement or intelligence officers, but one could never be too certain. Ali would be the arbiter of his fate. Chapter 19. The door opened, and Karim Talib looked suspiciously through the crack, a thin chain linking the door to the frame.
"Salam,"
Ali said with a disarming smile.
"Salam, Tijori,"
the smaller man replied.
"I'm well, Karim. May I come in?"
Ali said, switching from Farsi to English.
"Of course,"
Karim responded, bowing his head and pushing the door closed to disengage the chain barrier before holding it open for his guest. He had been expecting the visitor.
"Mochaker hastam. Are your wife or children home?"
Ali asked.
"No, they are at the park. I don't expect them for another hour."
"Good.
Let's talk, Karim," May I have some tea?
Manre Bilkash, yes,
Karim said, nervously putting his hand to his heart.
Please follow me.
Ali trailed behind the shorter man down a hallway and into a small kitchen with aging linoleum floors. As Karim filled a pot with water and set it on the electric coil stove, Ali pulled a photo from a magnet on the refrigerator.
Is this your family, Karim?
Yes, my wife and two sons. They are handsome boys,
Ali noted.
How old are they?
4 and 6.
You seem too old to have such young children.
My first wife died in childbirth. Our daughter did not survive. I did not remarry for many years.
I am sorry, Karim. Even the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, lost 6 of his 7 children.
They await, and I will see them again on the day of recompense,
Karim whispered, placing a mesh strainer into a small ceramic blue teapot.
Ah, that you will, Karim. Allah will ensure you will once again be at peace.
Karim nervously watched as his guest examined the photos and drawings on the refrigerator and inspected the small living area just off the kitchen.
How do you like your tea?
Strong, Karim. Do you know why I am here?
Karim's hand quivered, some of the boiling water spilling down the side of the teapot as he poured the hot liquid over dried leaves and rose petals.
I was told only to expect you, that you would have a job for me.
Not just any job, Karim. A mission from Allah.
Ali watched his subject cover the teapot.
We will let it steep for about 5 minutes.
I understand you have not been to your mosque in quite some time, Karim.
It is best not to be noticed coming and going from mosques in Chicago. The American agents are everywhere.
Ali folded his arms. Chicago had one of the fastest-growing Muslim populations in the country. Close to 500,000 children of Allah called the Windy City home, and 15 new mosques had been built in the past decade. Chicago was not a city where a Muslim would have a hard time blending in.
Have the American authorities ever tried to contact you?
No. As far as I can tell, I am still clean.
Ah, I see. And where do you and your family practice Salat?
Ali asked, referring to the 5 daily prayers that were the second pillar of Islam. He intentionally looked down the hall and into the living room. Karim slowly removed 2 clear glass teacups from the cupboard and set them on the counter, gathering his thoughts.
Has faith left your heart, Karim?
Karim drew in a deep breath and whispered,
No,
with as much emotion as he could muster.
Have you not come to terms with what you did for Allah?
Karim pushed his hands together in an attempt to steady them.
Here, let me help,
Ali offered, gesturing to the small kitchen table where his host reluctantly took a seat. The assassin took charge and poured a splash of tea into both cups to warm them and check the brew for consistency. Judging the tea was strong enough for his liking, he then poured them back into the pot before filling both cups to the halfway point, adding a dash of hot water to each. Karim did not notice the small, wax-infused wafer that his visitor slid into his cup. It dissolved immediately, and Ali placed the steaming hot liquid in front of his asset.
Merci,
Karim said, thanking his unwelcome caller, thinking back to the day his adopted country was attacked, an attack he had helped facilitate, an attack that occurred on the day his wife died in childbirth, September 11th, 2001.
Khahesh Mikonam,
Ali responded.
Why are you nervous, Karim? Allah has chosen you to finish what you started 20 years ago.
Karim took a sip of the dark tea to steady his nerves.
Please,
his voice trailed off.
If you are no longer devoted to the cause, I can understand that, Karim. You have a nice life here in Chicago. Do you want me to leave?
I am not the person that I was. Allah now has a different calling for me, to raise my 2 sons. I am sorry.
I am sorry too, Karim.
Karim felt his pulse begin to race. He looked into the eyes of the man who he now knew had decided to kill him. He gazed back into his tea, struggling to focus, feeling an unnatural sweat beginning to permeate his glands.
How do you feel, Karim? You do not look well.
Ali had used the technique before. In Europe, he had concentrated natural-occurring regulatory neuropeptides that control stress, emotions, and arousal into high doses, doses large enough to cause heart attacks, seizures, and strokes. He had looped the DNA sequences into a simple bacterial culture for delivery via spray or wafer. It was completely undetectable in an autopsy, as peptides are so efficiently metabolized by the body that they are gone seconds after absorption. The concoction had sent more than a few enemies of Iran to paradise. Karim looked at Ali in horror as his body began to react to the overdose of neuropeptides. As he struggled to breathe, the cold sweat was replaced by a bout of nausea. His chest felt like it was being crushed by an invisible block of iron. His vision blurred and he made a feeble lunge for the kitchen counter, knocking over his tea before collapsing to the floor. Ali took a sip of the dark liquid. He would have preferred it stronger. He crossed his legs and watched as Karim struggled to breathe on the dirty linoleum tile. He waited another 5 minutes after Karim had stopped breathing and finished his tea. He then washed out his cup in the sink using a paper towel to turn on and off the water, and also to dry out his cup before replacing it in the cupboard. He then exited the home and walked the 3 blocks back to his car. Chicago would be spared. No matter. This contingency had been built into the plan. Ali had another city to visit. He made his way out of Chicago and merged onto I-65. Setting his cruise control to the speed limit, he drove south toward Atlanta. Chapter 20. Chicago, Illinois. Reese had done one drive-by of the Target house and then circled back onto West Devon Avenue, passing a Dunkin' Donuts, a Domino's Pizza, a tobacco shop, a Honda dealership, a hookah lounge, and, ironically, the Iraqi Mutual Aid Society, located within a stone's throw of the Tel Aviv Kosher Bakery. This one street on the outskirts of Chicago was a multicultural microcosm of American society, where Italian, Mexican, and Chinese restaurants shared the street with Lahore Food and Grill and the Salvation Army. He passed a synagogue, a mosque, and a church within blocks of one another. Driving by a business awning signage that read Baghdad Hair Salon, he did a double take and almost missed his turn, flashing back to a mission on the streets of Iraq's capital city in a thin-skinned Humvee. The West Ridge neighborhood of Chicago was far enough outside the loop that it had been spared the rioting and looting of the previous summer. Reese couldn't help but think how much better the country might be without politicians stoking the coals of division. They excelled at stirring up hate and discontent to advance partisan political agendas in an attempt to persuade their voting blocs that they were the answer to the very problems they were creating. Those who sell the panic sell the pill. Those politicians might be responsible for more deaths than your target, Reese. The former frogman was acutely aware that his Land Cruiser stood out. He could have gotten away with it in a few California seaside surf communities or the back roads of the Pacific Northwest or a ski town in the Wasatch or Rockies, but in suburban Chicago, vintage off-road vehicles were not the order of the day. If he was going to go through with this mission, he would need to do it right. That meant a team. It meant indigenous vehicles. It meant technical and physical surveillance. It meant building a pattern of life and getting creative with the method of termination. Then what the hell are you doing here? Reese's attention was drawn to a woman descending the steps of the small single-story home with 2 young children in tow. He watched them disappear down the street and found himself thinking of Lauren and Lucy walking to the park in Coronado together. Beauty, innocence, and hope shattered at the business end of an AK. Shifting his focus back to the house, Reese wondered if his target was inside. Am I about to do to this family what was done to mine at the behest of the same government? According to the file, this man facilitated 9/11, Reese. He deserves what's coming. Justice.
Justice?
Or retribution? Just over 20 years ago, Karim Talib had lived in Florida. He'd taken flying lessons at Huffman Aviation in 1999, but dropped out well before he'd completed the 35 hours required for a private pilot's license certification. He was not a U.S. citizen at that point and had moved to Chicago shortly thereafter. A year later, Muhammad Atta, Ziad Jarrah, and Marwan al-Shehi applied for training. Talib had conducted what was known in special operations circles as an advance force operation. He had confirmed that a dark-skinned Muslim on a student visa could apply for flight training in the United States without getting a visit from the FBI. By all indications, Talib had been living his life as a U.S. citizen for almost two decades without any negative interaction with law enforcement or U.S. intelligence agencies. Had he reformed? Or was he just biding his time, waiting for his next assignment? That was not Reese's department. This man was a foreign agent, responsible for the deaths of almost 3,000 Americans, citizens with families and dreams, just like Lauren and Lucy. His actions had forfeited his right to citizenship. It was time for him to die. The man who knocked on the door to the home wearing what most people still called a COVID mask could have been anyone, a friend, relative, neighbor, or business associate. He spoke briefly to the man who opened the door and then disappeared inside.
Shit! I should have had my phone ready, or even better, had a high-resolution camera with a zoom lens. Rookie!
20 minutes later, the man reemerged alone and casually made his way down the street, away from Reese's position. The camera on Reese's iPhone wasn't bad, but it was not made for taking surveillance photos through windshields at over 100 yards. Something about the way the man moved put Reese on edge. He'd seen it in the instructors at the farm, men and women who had been trained to blend in while still remaining situationally aware in non-permissive environments. He took a burst of photos and resisted the urge to follow the visitor.
Stay on target.
Reese forced down a sip of coffee from the 26-ounce Yeti Rambler in the seat next to him. The mini-mart where he'd filled up hadn't had any honey, so he'd been forced to substitute with artificial sweeteners and French vanilla creamer. Reese made a mental note to dig out his Black Rifle coffee travel kit and keep it in his vehicle. The woman and children returned around noon. Less than 10 minutes later, the first police car arrived. Reese continued to snap pictures with his phone as a fire truck roared down the street and came to a stop in front of the Target house, an ambulance and another police cruiser close behind. The paramedics entered the home with two large medical packs as two EMTs pulled a wheeled stretcher from the back of the ambulance and maneuvered it inside.
What the fuck is going on? Reese wondered.
In less than 5 minutes, the medical team reemerged with a body strapped to the gurney. They loaded the patient into the back and sped off with sirens blaring. Moments later, the woman and children rushed down the steps and into an aging Civic, taking off after the ambulance. Reese exited his vehicle and approached a police officer who was talking to a firefighter.
"Hey, guys," Reese said, holding up his marshal badge. "I was just driving by. What happened?"
"Heart attack,"
the officer responded.
"That's too bad," Reese said.
"Will he make it?"
The officer looked to the firefighter, who shook his head.
"He's gone. We still rushed them to the hospital as a matter of protocol. He'd only been out for 30 minutes or so. Probably could have saved him if he'd been able to call 911.
"Did the wife find him?"
Reese asked.
"Kids found him first. Always tough."
Reese contemplated telling the cop that he'd seen a man leave the house just minutes before the family had returned, but that would have led to additional questions. Reese had already pushed it enough.
"So rough," Reese agreed. "You guys stay safe. Thanks for holding the line."
"You too, deputy."
Reese crossed the street and walked back toward his cruiser. "There is no such thing as a coincidence" was a popular saying in spy novels and movies. In real life, Rhys knew that coincidence was a real thing. That is why it was a defined term. Then what is this? Who is the man who arrived just prior to Talib's family returning? Had he killed the first target on Rhys's list? Though he knew it was a fruitless effort, Rhys took his time getting out of town, slowly weaving his way through the surrounding streets on the off chance he might see the man in the mask. Still perplexed by the mysterious visitor, Rhys turned south onto the interstate toward the next name on his list. Chapter 21. Charlie Crimmins hadn't expected Rhys to bolt out of town. They certainly had not expected him to drive from Virginia to Illinois, but the tracking device they detected